Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. Remember to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. Now, here's our pastor and teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are continuing working our way verse by verse, chapter by chapter through the Old Testament. We are in 2 Kings and we are all the way to chapter 11. We're going to try to cover chapter 11 and 12 tonight. They're not particularly long chapters and they are full of narrative and story. The storyline at this point is about the succession again of kings in the north and in the south. But chapter 12 in particular is very interesting because it has to do with Joash, sometimes called Jehoash, Joash becoming king in the south and his efforts to rebuild and modify the temple itself, which over time has begun to run down. So chapter 11 and chapter 12 are really about Joash, how he becomes king, and the power struggle surrounding him becoming king. Now, he becomes king at a very young age. He becomes king at the age of 7. So, you know, what are you guys doing? I mean, king at 7, you are wasting time. That's all I'm saying. So whenever I read these kinds of passages that seem to be narrative primarily, I wonder why it is that the author, who is probably Jeremiah, picked these particular stories to tell, because as you've noticed oftentimes through 1 and 2 Kings, he makes reference to now the rest of what that king did you can find in the Chronicles of the Kings, which is apparently an ongoing history of the kings of Judah or the kings of Israel, a chronicle that lists the important events and the things that they did. We don't appear to have that. By the way, it's not 1 and 2 Chronicles. That's not what he's making reference to. He's making reference to an ongoing chronicle of the activity of the kings. So since that already exists, since a chronicle of what these kings did exists, I ask the question, well, then why recite this particular story? For instance, you have the whole life of Joash here. So you have a lot of things that Joash did that you could choose from, that you could emphasize. Why these things? Well, obviously, Jeremiah, in picking out these particular things, is picking them out because he is emphasizing each successive king's relationship to God. That's what's important to him. He doesn't care about the political machinations. He doesn't care about the day-to-day stuff, the taxation. He doesn't care that much about the marriages. We assume Joash had wives. He has children. It just never comes up in Jeremiah's accounting of the story because he's able to say, if you want to know the rest of it, go read the Chronicles. But he emphasizes these particular things because they're important to him in explaining how it is that Israel went from being such a blessed nation that they had King David, a man after God's own heart, a man that God made a particular covenant with, that his descendants would always rule on the throne of Judah. Ultimately, the Messiah himself would come from the family and the lineage of David. David wanted to build a house for God, and God said, I'm going to build a house for you, a dynasty, a lineage for you. So that when Jesus came into Jerusalem at the triumphal entry, they cried, Hosanna to the Son of David, that lineage of David, very, very important. And yet, somehow, Israel in the north and Judah in the south, despite starting as a unified 12-tribe nation, and having David as king, and then from David on to Solomon, a great king who had the kind of wisdom that other foreign kings would come just to witness his splendor, how grand he was, all his horses and his stables and his men and his chariots, but then they were really amazed at his wisdom. So this was like the zenith of Israel's life and career from when they came out of Egypt, building up through the times of the judges, to saying we want a king, to finally getting to David and Solomon, the kings that God chose for them. And somehow, over the course of only a few hundred years and a few generations of kings, they went from David to utter apostasy to a series of deportations out of their land by foreign kings who took over their area, starting with the northern tribes going into the Assyrian captivity, and to this very day, never returning to that land in Canaan that was promised to them in perpetuity as a result of both the Abrahamic covenant and the Davidic covenant. So really what Jeremiah is concentrating on as he writes about the succession of kings is occasionally there's a good king, occasionally in the south there's something good to say, but he's really telling you why it went from bad to worse to worse to worse, so that by the end of this book, by the end of 2 Kings, the Assyrian captivity will have happened. And so if you just read the arc of 1 and 2 Kings, you come out of 1 and 2 Samuel, you come out of David, and then you get to King Solomon, and you get to the splendor of Solomon, and over the arc of 1 and 2 Kings, you get to the Assyrian captivity. So 1 and 2 Kings is really all about the successive downfall of Israel. And that's really, I think, what Jeremiah's focus is and why he picks the particular stories that he chooses. Now, what we're going to see tonight is not only the very human characteristic of lust for power. We have an election coming up here in the United States next year, and so already we have people getting online and petitioning, going on TV and putting out their campaigns, people who want to be the most powerful man in the United States and arguably the most powerful man in the world. This lust for power has not in any way been mitigated or reduced over the course of human history. And chapter 11 is really about the lust for power, the desire for power. And chapter 12 is really about money, the natural gravitation to enrich oneself, and in this case, to enrich oneself off the ministry. And so these are the stories that Jeremiah chose because these are the stories that he wanted us to understand in the successive degradation and downfall of national Israel. Got all that? Mm-hmm. Okay. That was not all introduction. That was merely a preamble. I no longer do introductions. I now do preambles. On Sunday, I did preparatory remarks, which is just really going to upset your plan for my tombstone, isn't it?
It is.
It is.
You have to stick around.
So I have no option but stick around. Okay, everybody in chapter 11 of 2 Kings? Okay, so we're going to talk about Athaliah, who becomes the queen of Judah. Now, Athaliah is the mother of Ahaziah. Do you remember Ahaziah? Go backwards to chapter 9 for a moment. Because Jehu, who was a reasonably good king in the north, who was handpicked by God, who was actually made king through the prophet Elisha, this Jehu killed off both the northern and the southern kings. Ahaziah was the king of the south, who made the mistake of getting himself embroiled in the wars and controversies of the household of Ahab. And the household of Ahab had a curse on them. You might remember that from last week. And so Jehu is out there implementing the curse that is on the household of Ahab. And in chapter 9, verse 27, we read, when Ahaziah, the king of Judah, the king of the southern portion of the kingdom, when he saw this, he fled by the way of the garden house. Jehu pursued him and said, shoot him too in his chariot. So they shot him at the ascent of Gur, which is at Ibleam. But he fled to Megiddo and he died there. And then his servants carried him in a chariot to Jerusalem and buried him in his grave with his fathers in the city of David. So Ahaziah is now dead. Meanwhile, his mom is back at Judah and she gets news that her son, the current king, is dead. Now, she has other sons who could potentially become the next king. But mom decides, you know, if I kill all my children, I can rule. And that's exactly what she does. The lust for power. When Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she rose and destroyed all the royal offspring. Some commentators say that she just killed her children. She may have killed her children and anybody else who might be able to make a claim to the throne. In her desire to rule Judah, she made herself queen by killing off anyone else who had a claim to the throne. But Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him from among the king's sons who were being put to death. So she wouldn't have gone in herself and killed them. Instead, she sent guards in to kill them. And just before that happened, Ahaziah's sister goes in and takes Joash, who is the youngest child of the king. So she's grabbed a piece of the royal lineage and is now going to take him and hide him. And she hides him in the temple. She placed him with his nurse in the bedroom, so they hid him from Athaliah, and he was not put to death. Keep your finger there for a moment. Turn to 2 Chronicles. 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles oftentimes cover the same material and oftentimes cover it the same way. But occasionally, the chronicler adds a little bit of extra information. The main difference between 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, and the reason that they rewrite and recover some of the same material, is that one is telling the whole story from the south perspective and one is telling the story from the north's perspective. But if you look at chapter 22 of 2 Chronicles, we're going to start in verse 11. Well, we should go back and start before that. Let's start in verse 8, because this is about Jehu murdering the princes of Judah, the southern kingdom. It came about when Jehu was executing judgment on the house of Ahab that he found the princes of Judah and the sons of Ahaziah's brothers ministering to Ahaziah, and he slew them. He also sought Ahaziah, the king of the south, and they caught him while he was hiding in Samaria. And they brought him to Jehu, and they put him to death, and they buried him, for they said, "He is the son of Jehoshaphat, who sought the Lord with all his heart." That's the reason that they buried him. So there was no one of the house of Ahaziah to retain power in the kingdom. Now, when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she rose and destroyed all the royal offspring of the house of Judah. But Jehoshabeth, the king's daughter, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him from among the king's sons who were being put to death, and she placed him and his nurse in the bedroom. So Jehoshabeth, the daughter of King Jehoram, here's the important part, the wife of Jehoiada the priest. That's a piece of information you don't get from 2 Kings. So she hid him from Athaliah so that she would not have him put to death, and he was hidden with them at the house of God. Now we know how it is that he ended up being hidden in the temple, in the house of God, in a private bedroom. He was there for 6 years while Athaliah reigned over the land because she was married to the priest in the temple. You get all the political connections now? You know all the players? Okay, good. All you need to know is that Joash is hidden away for 6 years. He becomes king when he's 7, which means he's hidden away when he's 1 year old. And that he is raised in the house of the Lord, under the hand and under the tutelage of a priest. And the priest is married to the king's sister, to Ahaziah's sister. So here's what's happening to Joash. We're back in 2 Kings. She's just crying because we're reading about a mother killing all her children. And she's upset. I would cry. So now we're back in chapter 11 of 2 Kings. Verse 2 will make more sense to us now. But Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him from among the king's sons who were being put to death, and placed him and his nurse in the bedroom. So they hid him from Athaliah, and he was not put to death. So he was hidden with her in the house of the Lord for 6 years while Athaliah was reigning over the land. Now, in the seventh year, Jehoiada sent and brought the captains of hundreds and the Kerites of the guard and brought them to him in the house of the Lord. Then he made a covenant with them, put them under oath in the house of the Lord, and then showed them the king's son. In other words, he brought in the captains, he brought in the guards that guard the temple all the way back to David. He set up the Kerites, sometimes called the Kerethites. These are all temple guards. And he brings them in and he makes a deal with them, a covenant it's called, an agreement, where he says, I'm going to show you something that you have to keep completely secret. And then shows them Joash, the real king, who's a mere 7 years old. He commanded them, says verse 5, saying, this is the thing that you shall do. One third of you who come in on the Sabbath and keep watch over the king's house. Then verse 6 says parenthetically, one third also shall be at the gate Shur, and one third at the gate behind the guards. And you will keep watch over the house for defense. And two parts of you, even all that go out on the Sabbath, shall also keep watch over the house of the Lord for the king. All this means is that they come and guard the house of the Lord in three parts. And some go in every Sabbath and some go out every Sabbath. And they're on a three-part rotation. And so what he's doing is getting them all to swear that they're going to keep watch over the house of the Lord, because no longer are they simply protecting the house of the Lord, they're now protecting the king. They have become the king's guard. Verse 8, then you shall surround the king, each with his weapons in his hand, and whoever comes within the ranks shall be put to death. And be with the king when he goes out and when he comes in. So the captains of hundreds did according to all that Jehoiada the priest commanded. And each one of them took his men who were to come in on the Sabbath with those that were to go out on the Sabbath, and they came to Jehoiada the priest. And the priest gave to the captains of hundreds the spears and the shields that had been King David's, which were in the house of the Lord. There's real significance here, and I don't want you to miss it. King David had a series of golden shields made.
Right, I remember those. Those were set in the temple before.
And they were set in the temple. And so here is the king hiding in the house of God. And so he breaks out David's shields and gives them to them to protect the king, because he is the last remaining survivor of the lineage of David. And if he's gone, the covenant promise God made to David is over. So why is this little boy, this little seven-year-old, being protected this way? Because God, in his absolute sovereignty, told David in a covenant, in a promise God made with himself, that there was no way that his lineage would ever be fully cut off, because Messiah has to come through the lineage of David. He has to come from the household of Judah, and he has to come as the lineage of David. And so even when Athaliah, the evil queen, cuts off her own children and her own posterity, God makes sure to keep his promise to David and keep the lineage alive. And then they go get the shields of David, the golden shields that are left there in the house of the Lord, and those are brought out to protect the lineage of David. Verse 11, and the guards stood, each with his weapon in his hand, from the right side of the house to the left side of the house, by the altar and by the house around the king. Then he brought the king's son out, And he put the crown on him, and he gave him, the next words say, and they gave him the testimony. What that means is they put a copy of the law in his hands, the covenant that was made between the household of Israel and God. Perhaps it's a copy of the Pentateuch. It's at very least a copy of the law. It's the very writing, the very emblem of the fact that Israel belongs to God. And as he's starting out his kingship at 7 years of age, they put the crown on his head that he is the lineage of David, the posterity of the kingship and the household of David, but he's given the testimony to hold in his hands to remember, now as we crown you king, the real deal is between you and God. Verse 12. Now they brought the king's son out, and they put the crown on him. They gave him the testimony, and they made him king, and they anointed him, and they clapped their hands, and they said, "Long live the king." When mom heard this, because Athaliah hears about it, verse 13, when she heard the noise of the guard and of all the people, she came out to the people in the house of the Lord, and she looked, and behold, there's her 7-year-old son standing there with a crown on his head, holding the covenant of God in his hands. She's not happy. And she looked, verse 14, and behold, the king was standing by the pillar, according to the custom, with the captains and the trumpeters beside the king, and all the people of the land rejoiced and blew trumpets. Then Athaliah tore her clothes, and she cried, "Treason, treason!" Thinking, apparently, that people would go, "Yes, this is treason against the queen who has ruled us for the last 6 years by killing all her own children. Yeah, we're with her." They're so excited to see that they actually have a king. They all side with the king because he is the actual natural descendant. And by the way, given that she has a penchant for killing off her children, what are the chances that you can trust the covenant to her? You can't. But here's the king standing by the pillar, which was the custom of the kings, being crowned in the very place where the kings are crowned. He's got the crown on his head. He's holding the covenant of the Lord in his hands. The people, of course, gather to him. And then exactly the right thing happens to her, verse 15. And Jehoiada the priest commanded the captains of hundreds who were appointed over the army and said to them, "Bring her out between the ranks, and whoever follows her, put to death with the sword." For the priest said, "Let her not be put to death in the house of the Lord." So they're there in the temple. Obviously, don't kill her here. This is the house of the Lord. Don't let blood be spilled here. But take her out. Take her through the ranks. Take her through the people and carry her outside. And if anybody follows her, just cut them down right there. She can't have any followers whatsoever. Verse 16, so they seized her. And when she arrived at the horse's entrance of the king's house, she was put to death there. Now, Jehoiada the priest made a covenant between the Lord and the king and the people that they should be the Lord's people. Also, he made a covenant between the king and the people. This is what is missing from the vast majority of world politics today. Here, because they are God's people, they are God's chosen elect people, they are Israel, they do have the covenants, they are the descendants of Abraham, they do have the law, they have Moses, they have the history, they have Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they have David, they have the Davidic covenant, and so when Jehoiada crowns him as king, he makes an agreement between the king and God and the people to remind the people who they belong to. That even though they now have a king and they're very excited about a king, they're very happy to find out that the lineage of David is not gone. But in the middle of all that, they have to be reminded who they belong to. That even the king has a king. That there is a higher authority than the politics. And any ruler, any king who recognizes that God is still sovereign over him and over the people We'll treat the people as if they belong to God and not to the government. And too much, as I said, of modern politics and rule and governing is sinful people ruling over other sinful people. And some sinful people seem to think that the rest of the sinful people live to serve them. But the earliest documents in the establishment of our nation speak of God, speak of our Maker, speak of the fact that the ultimate authority is supposed to be God. Oh, I gotta get off this subject or I'll start waxing political. But one of the reasons that our founding fathers wrote that sort of language into our founding documents was because they did get the idea that every man belonged ultimately to his Maker and not to the government, because they had been under the rule of the king. And the king was also the head of the church. And so they had both a religious and a political obligation to the government. And so that's why in our founding documents, the concept of the separation of church and state was such an important idea that's been turned completely on its head now. The idea behind separation of church and state, which is a phrase you don't find anywhere in any of our founding documents. It's actually only found in a letter that Jefferson wrote. And what he was talking about was making sure that the state never encroaches on the free exercise of the church. And now, 200 years later, our government thinks that the purpose of the separation of church and state is to keep the church from encroaching on the society or the government. And this is why we're all longing for, kind of looking for, kind of hoping for any political figure that will stand up and say, God is real and God is alive and this nation and the people in it and everything that's in it all belong to God, including the cattle on a thousand hills, and we are merely stewards of it. If somebody stands up and talks like that, we go, oh, finally, we gravitate toward it. Because ultimately, this is a reality. God owns everything, and Jehoiada the priest made sure that the beginning of Joash's reign, though he was merely 7 years old, was going to be a reign that understood, this is why he's holding the testimony, that he would understand that the ultimate covenant is not between the king and the people. The ultimate covenant is between the collective people and king and God. You got all that?
Yes.
So this is really admirable what's happening here. The reestablishment of the covenant, the reestablishment of the recognition that the people belong to God, they don't just belong to the king. Verse 18, and all of the people of the land went to the house of Baal and tore it down. Good reaction. Why did they do that? Because someone had the courage to stand up and remind them who they were. You are the chosen of God. You are the elect of God. You are the people of God. You are in covenant with God. You are the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. You are the ones who have the covenants and the promises. Therefore, act like it. And they went out and started tearing down the false religion because they were appropriately reminded of who they are. By the way, now we can get theological. This is a consistent pattern all the way through the Bible. The Apostle Paul makes it really obvious in the way that he structures his letters and the way that he structures his theology. But if you want to motivate people to godly living, to righteousness, the best thing to do is remind them of who they are in God. If all you give people is stuff to do, but they don't understand why they're called to do it, then you have vacuous religion. You just have the religion of doing. And you have the religion of people thinking, well, I must be okay because I'm doing the stuff. The theological term for this, and we've talked about it a lot here, is the difference between the indicative and the imperative. Indicative indicates. Imperative is a rule. Go do this, a command. Do this. All religion, all false religion, all wrong religion puts the imperative ahead of the indicative and says, if you do this, you can be this. If you do the work, if you do whatever our thing is, if you follow our traditions, if you do our stuff, then you can be this. All religion does that. You want nirvana? Okay, well then do this. You want your 70 virgins? Blow yourself up. Do this in order to be this. Paul never does that. All of Paul's theology starts with, you are this. You are beloved. You are saved. You are redeemed. You are blood-bought. You are chosen before the foundation of the world. And then knowing that about yourself, do this. Mm-hmm. Act like this. Live like this. And if you can ever get that straight in your head, not only will you think more biblically, but you'll finally find an appropriate motivation for Christian behavior. Because if Christian behavior is treated like a carrot on a stick, where you're constantly saying, chase the carrot of your behavior, and then God will reward you, God will do things for you, God will react to you if you just do enough good things, well, that's a fool's errand. That's a losing game, because you can never be good enough to obligate God. But if I can reassure you that God has already done for you everything necessary for your salvation, if I can reassure you that the finished work of Christ is, in fact, fully sufficient, if I can convince you that God is not mad at you because you are accepted in the Beloved One, I can then tell you, now, knowing all that about yourself, how should you be? You should be different. You should act different. Because you are different. You are the people of God. This is the same thing you see here. It's consistent throughout the Bible. It started with reestablish the covenant. Who are you? You're Israel. You're Judah. You're the chosen of God. You're the descendants of David. You're the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You're the ones who God has made covenant with, unlike any covenant he has ever made with any other people group ever on the planet. That's who you are. And what do? They run right out and tear down the house of Baal. No more of that. No, that false worship, we got to quit that. We have to go back to God. You get it? Mm-hmm. Listen, if somebody comes to me and they say, I'm having a real crisis. I'm having a life crisis. I'm having a marriage crisis. I'm having a family crisis. I'm having a spiritual crisis of some kind. And all I say to them is, well, then work harder. Have I helped them? You know? If you two come to me, just because you're the married couple in the room at the moment. Oh, there's another one back there. But if you two were to come to me and say, we're having a marriage problem, we're really struggling in our marriage. If all I say to you is, work harder, does that fix it? It does nothing for you. Because if you could work harder, you would have already. In fact, you wouldn't be coming to talk to me about it because you'd already have done everything you could do. You'd have exhausted all your resources before you came to me. And then all I give you is, do better, bye-bye now, and good luck with that. That's no help to you at all. But if I can get you both to understand who you are in Christ, everything he has done for you, the way he forgave you, who you were by nature when he forgave you, oh, well, then I can use that as motivation to say, now forgive him, now forgive her. Because I have started with, who are you in Christ? What is God like? What has God done for you? And I can move you from there to, here's your motivation for working this out together. Because you're finding your motivation external to yourself rather than in you somewhere. Do you get it? Do you understand the difference? This is just a huge theological concept that I return to with fair regularity because it changed everything for me. I mean, once I got this right, however many years ago, it changed everything. It changed what kind of parent I was. It changed everything. But you see it exemplified here again that Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king and the people, that they should be the Lord's people. And all the people of the land went to the house of Baal and tore it down, his altars and his images, and they broke it in pieces thoroughly, and they killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altar. And the priest appointed officers over the house of the Lord. And he took the captains of hundreds and the Kerites and the guards and all the people of the land, and they brought the king down from the house of the Lord and came by the way of the gate of the guards to the king's house. And he sat on the throne of the kings. So all the people of the land rejoiced in the city, and it was quiet, for they had put Athaliah to death with the sword at the king's house, and Joash was 7 years old when he became king. Yes?
I can understand the rejoicing at the new child king showing up, but it also means that for 6 years, they thought the Davidic covenant had expired, and that had to have been cataclysmic to their faith.
I like your perspective, which is there had to be people thinking, well, now that Athaliah is queen, and she has no more children, and she's killed her children, when she dies, that is the end of the Davidic line. What do we do? And the answer is, have faith, God knows what he's doing. If God is indeed sovereign, even when circumstances look bad, how have I defined faith for all these years? It's counting God's word is more true than your circumstances. And so they could look at the circumstances and say, circumstances look bad. But trust God, he knows what he's doing. And yes, after 6 years, when they trot out Joash, of course they were celebrating. It was like God hasn't forgotten us. And what does the priest do? Reestablish the covenant with them. God hasn't forgotten. He knows what he's doing. Any of us who have an expectation, going through a struggle, going through pain, 6 years is a long time. Especially if it looks like God's not going to keep his word. 6 years. Or, you know, I mentioned that Israel was taken out of their land in the Assyrian captivity, and they haven't been back in their land now ever since the Assyrian captivity. What are we going to say about that? Thousands of years. God has not returned them the way he said he was going to. And so our confidence has to be in the word of God, that if he said he's going to do it, he's going to do it. And that's all there is to that. Just because he hasn't done it yet
and hasn't told us about it,
he hasn't revealed to us the method he's going to use or how he's going to bring it about. What we know for sure is he's going to. And if he can do things like that, if he can move people groups and raise up kings and take down kings, if he can raise up nations and destroy nations, then he can take care of your 6-year problem, right? Or your 2-week problem, or your whatever the problem is. Faith in God remains consistent, even in situations where you think, well, this looks impossible. There's no way that God could keep his word in the midst of this. So I like your perspective, which is there had to be people who went, well, that's it, it's over. It wasn't over. God knew what he was doing. He had Joash there. He was keeping the lineage of David because he had to. Why does he have to? Because Jesus has to come through the lineage of David. So you can't kill the lineage of David. All right, so that takes us into chapter 12. Now, as I told you, Chapter 12, which is not a very long chapter, stick with me, it won't take very long. Chapter 12, unlike the lust for power, is about greed and money. Among the priests who were getting their money from the people, and the money is supposed to be used a certain way. So watch what happens. Chapter 12, verse 1. In the 7th year of Jehu, Joash became king. He, the 7-year-old, reigned for 40 years in Jerusalem. Nice long reign. Apparently died at 47, because I'm a math genius. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba, and Joash did right in the sight of the Lord all his days in which Jehoiada the priest instructed him. So notice he was raised the first 7 years of his life, for 6 years of his life. He's raised under the hand of Jehoiada in the house of God, which means that Jehoiada trained him, taught him the things of God, which is why he would stand there with the testimony in his hand. Jehoiada had the rare opportunity to raise up a king in a godly way and put him in front of the people, and God kept him there as king for 40 years. So Joash did right in the sight of the Lord all his days in which Jehoiada the priest instructed him. Only the high places were not taken away, and the people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places, which they're not to do. They were only supposed to worship in the temple. So Joash, says verse 4, said to the priests, this is after he's been alive for a while. In fact, we're going to find out in a minute that we're talking about the 23rd year of the reign of Joash here. Joash said to the priests, all the money of the sacred things which is brought into the house of the Lord in current money, both the money of each man's assessment and all the money which any man's heart prompts him to bring into the house of the Lord, let the priests take it for themselves, each from his acquaintance, and they shall repair the damage of the house wherever the damage may be found. Remember that this temple built by Solomon now has been around for several hundred years, and there have been several incursions into Jerusalem. There have been attacks and stuff, and the house of the Lord is in disrepair. And so he says, tell all the priests to do this. Currency, real money, not the grain offerings, not any sin offering, not anything that's already assigned, but money that people bring in, whether they bring it in willfully or whether it's something that is part of their assessment, because there were assessments depending on what you had, what you owned, a portion of it went to the priests. And he assigns the money and says, have them take that money and then use it to repair the damage to the house. Now, this is going to cut into the income of the priests. They're still going to have all their other income. But money that is brought in, and he says specifically from their acquaintances, from their family groups, there are several different priests that are working there. They're in rotations. And so specifically, they're going to get to know people. They're going to have families. They're going to have friends, acquaintances. They're going to be people that they particularly minister to. And so whenever those people bring money, give money to them, they're to use it to repair the house of God. That's the assignment of the king. Got it? Now, they're still going to eat because there are still offerings, sin offerings, everything else that belongs to them. They're going to be fine. They're going to eat. They still have a place to live. They're given housing. They're going to be fine. This is not going to hurt them at all financially. All they have to do is take money that's typically given to them and dedicate it back to the repair of the house of the Lord, which also, by the way, would take a limited amount of time. Once the repairs are done, we can go back to the way it was. All the king tells him to do. Verse 6. But it came about that in the 23rd year of King Joash, so he'd be 30 years old now, the priests had not repaired the damages of the house. They just kept taking the money. But they didn't do anything. They didn't fix anything. They just kept taking the money. So verse 7 says, then King Joash called for Jehoiada the priest and for the other priests and said to them, why do you not repair the damages of the house? This is typical human nature. He says to them, now therefore take no more money from your acquaintances, but pay it for the damages of the house. In other words, any money you take now has to go to the fixing of the house if you take any money in, okay? That's my rule now. If you take any money in from your acquaintances, from your family groups, from the people you're ministering to, from anybody who gives you personally some money, it has to go to fixing the Lord's house. Their response is the priests agreed that they just wouldn't take any money and they wouldn't repair the house. They just don't want the responsibility. I'm just not going to do it. So if I take money, it has to go to repairing the house. Well, that doesn't benefit me in any way at all. So I just won't take money.
I don't
want to do that work. Notice what's happening here. Who are they prioritizing?
Themselves.
This is the place of worship. This is the place where God has chosen to place his name. This is the house where the Ark of the Covenant is. This is the place where restitution is made on a yearly basis between God and man. This is the place that the Israelites are required to come 3 times a year up to Jerusalem and worship at the temple. This is the place every year where the Passover lamb is sacrificed. This is a really important place, but they were so used to just getting the money and taking it that they could not prioritize God over their own greed. And when they were told, okay, now it's a command. Now, if you take money, it has to go to fixing the house. They went, well, forget it then. Don't take any money. I'm not going to take any money, and we're not going to fix the house of the Lord. So what happens? Verse 8. So the priests agreed that they should take no more money from the people, nor repair the damages of the house. But Jehoiada the priest took a chest, bored a hole in its lid, and put it beside the altar on the right side as one comes into the house of the Lord, and the priests who guarded the threshold put in it all the money that was brought into the house of the Lord. So anybody who came in with a gift, they gave their gift at the door and the money went right into the chest. Never even reaches the priests. You're just not even going to see the money anymore. We're just going to put the money into the chest. And when they saw that there was much money in the chest, the king's scribe and high priest came up and tied it in bags and counted the money which was found in the house of the Lord, and they gave the money which was weighed out into the hands of those who did the work, who had the oversight of the house of the Lord. And they paid it out to the carpenters and to the builders who worked on the house of the Lord. So they actually literally bypassed the priests completely and gave the money to the people who did the work. Now, what's even more amazing is, in a minute we're going to read, that they didn't even require the workers to give them an accounting of the money. It had gotten so bad among the priesthood that they trusted the workers more than they trusted the priests. So the people would come in and bring their gifts, put it in Joash's chest. That's where that name comes from. And a chest with a hole in the top where people would put the money in. And then they counted out the money. It was sufficient money to pay the people to do the work, which is what they should have done in the first place. But the workers are more trustworthy than the religious leaders. So they gave the money to the masons and the stone cutters and for buying timber and hewn stone to repair the damages to the house of the Lord and for all that was laid out for the house to repair it. But there were not made for the house of the Lord silver cups or snuffers or bowls or trumpets or any vessels of gold or vessels of silver from the money that was brought into the house of the Lord. Why? Why didn't they make any of that stuff? Because that was all the stuff that the priests used in the service. So this was all about fix the structure, and the priests that wouldn't participate didn't gain any benefit from it. But the house of the Lord was repaired. Then we read in verse 15, moreover, they did not require an accounting from the men into whose hand they gave the money to pay to those who did the work, because they dealt faithfully. Isn't that remarkable? I saw you, Dwight. You actually went, wow. And that's exactly right. Now, we could make lots of applications here, and I could preach extensive sermons on giving, which I don't think I've ever done. But there is a principle to be had here. We could name our box on the wall Joash's chest. It is. It's a little chest with a hole in the top, isn't it? We can just put a sign right over it, Joash's chest. Except then everybody who comes in here and works thinks that's their money. But look at the difference between these two. Look at the contrast between these two situations. When the priests were told that the money that came into their hand was to be used for the house of the Lord, when they had to prioritize the Lord, They had become so used to thinking of their work in the temple as their job. And so they saw the offerings that were given to them as their payment. And they didn't want their payment to be cut because it was their job. It is one of the most... I'm trying to pick a really good word here. Because I was going to say dangerous, and that might be overstating the case, but it is one of the most conflicted attitudes that you can get in the ministry, is to start thinking that it's your job. Because it's not a job. It's a calling. It is a requirement that God places on people, that they are now conscripted into his service to do the work of the Lord. But if you start thinking of it as, this is my job, I go to work every day, I do the work of God, I get a paycheck, then you start thinking that the gifts that people give to the church somehow belong to you. Because after all, it's my job. One of the most difficult things for me to do was to make the transition from paying my own way to allowing the church to support me. Because my whole life, that type A driven personality, I had always paid my own way. I had always worked. I'd always paid my own bills. I had always taken care of myself. Self-made, all of that. Went through my whole life like that. For the first 8 years that we were a church, I didn't let the church give me any money because I wanted to pay my own way. I'm buying my own house. I'm paying my own bills. Didn't want to live in a parsonage. I didn't want the church to be responsible for buying my insurance because I didn't want the church to be able to take anything away from me if they didn't like the stuff I was saying. I know several preachers who I've known through the years. Okay, now I'm just going to tell stories out of school. But I've known several preachers through the years who have said to me, Jim, I'm convinced that what you teach is true. It's all about grace. God is sovereign. But I can't preach that because they'll take away my insurance, and I need the insurance. And they'll take away my parsonage, and I need that. That's where I live. Where's my family going to? How are my kids going to? I can't ever preach what you preach. They'll throw me out. And I never wanted to feel that conflict, so I paid my own way. And my attitude was, I'm going to tell the truth without having anybody be able to take anything from me. Well, said all that to say. Finally, the folks at GCA convinced me, the people who handled the money, once we had the building paid off, we had the land paid off, we had no more debt, and they said, you know, we can pay something, we ought to. In fact, the then secretary said to me, we don't want to be the church at Corinth. We don't want you to write to us the way Paul wrote to the church at Corinth and say, you've only lacked in this one thing, that I was never a burden to you. We should be paying you. So originally I said, all right, well, you can start paying my bills each month. So the church started picking up my utilities each month. And then over the course of time, at the exact moment that the job I was working went under, the church approached me and said, we can afford you now. We can give you a paycheck. I mean, just good providence. And for the first time, I said yes. Now, I told you all that background to say that was a really difficult decision for me because for the first time, I had to trust that you all would take care of me. And I wasn't sure I trusted you that much because I'm now dependent on every month the money has to come in. Internet listeners, people here locally, the money has to come in. And if the money doesn't come in, there were times, there were a couple of months, where I got the call from our church secretary, our then secretary, who said, there's not enough to pay you and the bills. We can't make it this month. So I said, pay the bills. Church first. Always church first. And then I'll live on whatever's left over. Now, God's been really good to us since then. That didn't happen often. And now we have money in the bank. Now, you know, we're kind of sitting better financially than we ever have. It's a really nice situation that we're in. And I have learned over the last 6 years to trust God that he will work through his people, and through his people, the church will be supported, the ministry will be supported, my bills will get paid. And it took a while to reach that level of trust. And I have to catch myself and not start thinking, this is my job and I earned this money. Instead, I have to remember that God is working through his people and that I trust them and they trust me. You know, you all put money in the box, which is now officially Joe Ash's chest. You all put money over there in Joe Ash's chest. And for the most part, you know, occasionally Tom will give you an accounting. You don't know what happens to the money once it goes in there. You just trust. You trust that it's going to be okay. And it is. When we spend the money, we tell you where we spend it and what we're doing with it. You know that I get paid. You know how much I get paid. We're real transparent about all that stuff. And as a consequence, the trust makes it work. The same way that when the priests paid the workers and the workers faithfully came and did the work, they didn't even require an accounting from them. Because the people of God are supposed to work on the basis of faith and trust. Not supposed to work on the basis of, well, I gave to you, so I own you. I gave to your church or your ministry, and so now I own you, and I can make demands of you. Nor can I say to you, you all owe me. I'm doing the work, you owe. Instead, it should be a matter of, you don't own me, but I give myself to you. And you don't owe me, but I trust you to take care of me. And that has worked for the last 6 years. And it works really well. And the contrast is right here in 2 Kings. They told the priests, when you get the money, spend it on taking care of the house of God. And the priests went, no, my money. I earn this. My job. I do the work. Me. So what happens? They lose that money. They end up having to say, okay, then we just won't take money. And we're not going to repair the house of the Lord. But what happens? The house of the Lord does get repaired. How? All the money is collected into Joash's chest. They get bypassed, and the money goes right to the workers on a basis of trust and faithfulness. And that's how it should be. In the household of God, trust and faithfulness is the way the relationship should work, especially where money's concerned. Make sense?
Makes sense.
All right, good. So let's wrap up here. Verse 15 says, moreover, they did not require an accounting from the men into whose hand they put the money to pay to those who did the work, for they dealt faithfully. The money from the guilt offerings and the money from the sin offerings was not brought into the house of the Lord because it did belong to the priests. The law of Moses says so. So they didn't shortchange the priests. They got what they deserved, what was theirs by law, but they didn't get their regular gifts anymore. Then, verse 17, complete change of topic. Then Hazael, the king of Aram, went up and fought against Gath and captured it. And Hazael set his face to go to Jerusalem. Now, Joash is a good king. Here's his first really major mistake. Remember what I said an hour ago. Why did Jeremiah include this information? Because he's showing the arc of the downfall of Israel. Here's Joash's huge mistake. Because he heard that Hazael of Aram, the Arameans, again, the Assyrians, had gone against Gath and they had captured it. So now Hazael is coming toward Jerusalem. He's going to come fight in Jerusalem. So what does Joash do? Verse 18, then Joash, king of Judah, took all the sacred things that Jehoshaphat and Jehoram and Ahaziah, his fathers, kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own sacred things, and all the gold that was found among the treasuries of the house of the Lord and of the king's house, and sent them to Hazael of Aram. And then Hazael went away from Jerusalem. He bought him off. And he bought him off with things that were dedicated to God. They didn't belong to the king to start with. These were dedicated things in the house of God that the kings through the years had been dedicating. All the gold, all of the precious stuff didn't belong to him. And rather than trust that God would protect his own people and protect his own house, he took it into his own hands to send the sacred things to a foreign king to buy him off so that he wouldn't attack Jerusalem. Enormous mistake, but a continuation of the downfall of Israel and Judah. And then Jeremiah says, now as for the rest of the acts of Joash. So in other words, I picked up these on purpose. These are the ones I want you to know because they fit the theme of my book as I show you ultimately that they're going to fall into the hand of the Assyrians. And then the southern tribes, Judah, are going to fall into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon. Now the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And his servants arose, and they made a conspiracy, and they struck down Joash at the house of Milo as he was going down to Selah. For Jozachar, the son of Shimeath, and Jehozabad, who was the son of Shomer, his servants struck him, and he died, and they buried him with his fathers in the city of David. And Amaziah, his son, became king in his place. He started out so well. He started out doing so good. And then made the critical error of not recognizing that the holy things belong to God, using them for his own personal protection and to keep his throne going. And so what happens? He's cut down and he's no longer king. Interesting stuff, huh? I like Jeremiah's choices of stories. And again, so amazing that these things that go back so many hundreds and thousands of years remain relevant to this very day, whether it's theological things like the indicative and the imperative, or whether it's just practical things like how money should be used in the household of God. It is still practical and applicable to us to this day. And boy, if there's a lesson to be had, it's first off, remember who you are in God. Let that be your motivation in life. And secondly, if it doesn't belong to you, you don't get to use it to save your own skin. If it belongs to God or the household of God, if it's a sacred thing, then trust God. He'll take care of you. The same Joash who, when his mother was cutting down the family, God protected him at a mere 1 year of age and spirited him off and kept him in the household of God and made him king at seven. That same God he couldn't trust when the foreign king was coming after him. He sees the Arameans coming and says, I know what I'll do. I'll take the sacred stuff from the house of God and give it to a foreign king. Started so well, ended so badly. So knowing all that, how many want to name their next son Joash? How many name your daughter Jezebel? Just raise up a whole family. Did you have your hand up, Micah?
Yeah, I was just going to say, every Wednesday we sit here and read about another king set up, yeah. And then they fail. They might start off good, but then they fail.
Yeah.
It's almost as if God is just demonstrating, you will not have a perfect king until I give you the perfect king.
There's going to be no peace till the Prince of Peace comes. And there will be no lasting kingdom till Christ sets up his kingdom.
Yeah. No human glory before
him. And no human's going to glory before God. And no matter how good, as you just said, and I agree completely, no matter how good it looks, no man can help you. Like I mentioned, there's an election coming up, and we always get excited and think, the next guy. He'll fix it.
We're desperate.
And then each one successively lets us down. Think about how Obama started. The level of excitement and expectation and hope and change and hope and change and just how excited we all were. And now we're all like, can we please get rid of this guy? Can we please move on to the next guy? Because we keep thinking the next guy's going to do it. But if we know anything from reading 1 and 2 Kings, the next guy is going to be the same as the previous guy because it's all fallen creatures ruling over fallen creatures. And that's never going to get you righteousness. That's just going to get you various levels of failure until the Prince of Peace sets up his kingdom. And then finally we'll find out what righteous government looks like. All right, collectively, say goodbye to the internet crowd.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. We welcome your feedback and encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.